This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The Republican Party has tightened its grip on the state of North Carolina. Voters chose former Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory for governor. State House and Senate have a veto-proof Republican majority, and they maintain their majority on the state's Supreme Court. And at least 9 of the state's 13-member congressional delegation will be Republicans. Meanwhile, voters here narrowly chose Mitt Romney over Barack Obama for president. Barack Obama, of course, reelected to the presidency with at least 303 electoral votes nationally. By early this morning, both men had spoken to their supporters.
And whether I earned your vote or not, I have listened to you. I have learned from you. And you've made me a better president. And with your stories and your struggles, I return to the White House more determined and more inspired than ever about the work there is to do and the future that lies ahead.
This election is over, but our principles endure. I believe that the principles upon which this nation was founded are the only sure guide to a resurgent economy and to renewed greatness. Like so many of you, Paul and I have left everything on the field. We have given our all to this campaign.
So how should we interpret the Republican victory in North Carolina, and what does the GOP stronghold in Raleigh mean for policy across our state? Here to help us with that is Jonathan Weiler, Director of Undergraduate Studies and an Adjunct Assistant Professor of Global Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Jonathan. Good to have
you. Thanks for having me.
And WUNC's Dave DeWitt is joining us as well. Dave, welcome to you.
Hi, Frank.
So, Jonathan, Barack Obama wins in North Carolina in 2008. He wins by 4,000 votes. Yesterday, he lost close to 97,000 votes. So what changed here in North Carolina for Barack Obama?
Well, I think probably the biggest thing that changed was just the overall picture in the state, which, as your opening suggests, has been trending Republican in recent years. Unemployment in the state of North Carolina is 9.7%. And so I think in those respects, President Obama, who really – frankly, won a miraculous victory here 4 years ago, a really unexpected one, was facing some very strong headwinds. I would say that at least at the presidential level, I think Democrats have reason to be encouraged that this state might continue to be genuinely in play going forward.
It was a narrow loss, much narrower than folks had predicted.
Absolutely, about 2%. So by far the most competitive state that Obama lost last night.
So, Dave, demographically, what happened? Were there shifts in the presidential race between 2008 and 2012 that are instructive?
No, I don't think so. I think we saw about the same amount, maybe a little bit less growth between the last 4 years than we had previously, mostly because of the economy. You know, a lot of people moved in. More people voted in 2012 than voted in 2008. More people obviously voted for the Republican candidate. But, you know, when people move in, they tend to move in from the Mid-Atlantic and states that are north. They tend to have a more moderate Democratic leaning. It's probably likely that there were more registered voters who were non-white this time than there were in 2008. But even with that influx of voters that would seem to lean Democratic, what you really saw was people, you know, voting against the president and his policies, not really for Mitt Romney. And you know, how does he win Ohio, Wisconsin, those states, and Michigan, and not win here? I think it's because he bailed out the auto industry. He didn't bail out the textile or the furniture industry. He didn't have that same sort of firewall, that same thing he could run on here that was positive that he did in those other states.
What do you think about that, Jonathan? I mean, North Carolina was considered a swing state. Was that ever really true? And how does it compare to those swing states that Obama really took?
Yeah, well, I think, again, clearly based on the result last night, just a 2-point loss, North Carolina clearly was a swing state. And I absolutely agree with Dave. I think the auto bailout turns out to have been one of the major stories of the campaign. And, you know, there's been so much focus on white working class voters who have been, at least in some ways of measuring that, have been trending away from the Democratic Party for a long time. But in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and even Iowa, that was much less true. And it's clear that that was an effect of both higher rates of unionization in those states and the auto bailouts. I think that's a big story.
The number I kept hearing from analysts and pollsters in North Carolina for the last year was 32%. Barack Obama needed to win at least 32% of the white vote to win North Carolina because the African-American vote and the smaller Latino vote were going to go his way, and they did. You know, when he was doing well, when he was polling well, he was up around that, if not a little bit higher. And he was right at that number in some of the last polls taken. I wouldn't be surprised once we get sort of more detailed reports that he was probably a little bit below that number, by 30-31%. But it was interesting. That was really the bellwether number. He needed to win 32% of the white vote to win North Carolina. He probably just fell just short of that.
What about women? They played an important part nationally in Barack Obama's victory. Did they play a role here in North Carolina, and did they break the same way?
He did win with women here in North Carolina. The gender gap in North Carolina is not as large as it is in some other states that he won, and some other states that he won, you know, narrowly. So why that is open for debate. But he does do better with women in North Carolina, and he didn't do well enough really with just sort of that general white vote. That he didn't get that 32% number.
Yeah, and I guess I would just add sort of on the national scene. You know, last night was a big night for women. It was a huge night for very popular women candidates, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, Tammy Baldwin, the first openly gay senator-elect in American history from Wisconsin. I think as of this morning, depending on the final outcome of the North Dakota race, there will be 20 women in the United States Senate, which is still only 20%, but it's by far a high watermark in our history. So I think last night was nationally a huge night for women. And just one more point. You know, Republicans lost two seats, one in Missouri and one in Indiana, that they had no business losing. And they lost those seats because very far-right Republican nominees made comments about rape related to abortion that really swung the tide of both those elections. So I think women in that regard were a big story in this election.
What about the Latino vote? Certainly we know Latino migration to this state has been important. Was the Latino vote important yesterday?
It was more important than it was in 2008, and that's probably the number that people will focus on. And that's true nationally. You saw that the Republican parties had a hard time reaching Latino voters, and you saw in sort of the postmortem last night, and this is true for North Carolina as it is for the country, in the postmortem you saw a lot of Republicans saying, we have to fix that problem we have with only appealing to white Americans, and especially to Latino voters. They feel like they can make some inroads here in this state and elsewhere. But that's something they'll have to focus on. And in North Carolina, Latino voters don't make up as high a percentage as they do in some other more southern states and southwestern states, certainly. But it is going to be a growing and more important electorate here.
What about the trends, though? If we see, I mean, there were some sort of strong liberal trends that we saw last night, as you suggested, more women. We saw pro-gay marriage amendments passing. So there's that is kind of going on. In the Republican aftermath, you see a lot of complaints and worry about being pushed too far to the right and being unelectable. On the other hand, that's what's happening in this state. Clearly, it's moving farther to the right than it had over the last couple of cycles. Is North Carolina simply going against the trend, or is there a trend that we're missing and we're paying too much attention to those perhaps ephemeral votes on other issues?
Well, I'll make a quick comment. I'll be interested to hear what Dave says about this. I mean, I think in some ways, excluding the presidential vote, North Carolina is becoming a lot more like the other Confederate states in that it's now at the state level come to be dominated by Republicans. So North Carolina clearly seems to be trending in that respect. I wanted to say one thing about the party moving too far to the right. Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, said earlier this week, he said, if we lose this election, if I hear people say Republicans were not conservative enough, I'm going to scream. And he said, we're not losing 95% of African Americans and 70% of Latinos because we're being too soft. So I think there's certainly some recognition among national Republican Party leaders. And it is noteworthy, if Lindsey Graham is the voice of moderation in your party, that's that itself is a kind of striking fact.
Shows you how far you've moved. Yeah.
You know, if you believe that last night was a turning point, especially if you look at the gay marriage issue, Maryland and Maine passed gay marriage laws. Minnesota voters turned down a gay marriage ban. It could be if last night was a turning point and we're going to see more states be more open to gay marriage. North Carolina could be the last state to approve a gay marriage ban going forward. And I think, you know, as you think of North Carolina in the future and you think, OK, there's a strong progressive streak that started in the middle of last century. And that's what sort of set North Carolina apart from other southern states. But today we wake up, it's a very red state, and it could be the last state to pass a gay marriage and civil union ban. And that will be a mark that North Carolina will have to live with for a long time.
Fascinating. So then in 2008, North Carolina becomes the southernmost state to vote for Barack Obama. It could become the last state to pass a ban on gay marriage. It's not a swing state. It's the riptide state. Things are going in both directions at once. We'll talk more about that as our conversation continues. Political scientist Jonathan Weiler, WUNC's Dave DeWitt, and we'll talk with Jessica Jones from our State House as our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Barack Obama reelected to the presidency yesterday. Democrats strengthened their hold on the U.S. Senate, picked up two new seats. Here in North Carolina, Republicans can claim a landslide. The governorship, State House, and the Senate, State Supreme Court all have solid Republican majorities. They increased the majorities that they already had or maintained what they had. So how to reconcile the results? UNC political scientist Jonathan Weiler with us today, our own Dave DeWitt. Joining us now by phone is Jeff DeBerry. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks, Frank.
You were just at a news conference. Governor-elect and Republican Pat McCrory was there, and he made this point about cooperation. Let's listen.
I don't want to make the mistake of any party, which has happened, is become arrogant with your power or majorities. I think that's a huge mistake that both parties have made in the past, and I don't want that to occur in the future.
Pat McCrory promising not to misuse his authority. What else did he say at that news conference?
He towed this line of really talking about a bipartisan approach. Now, of course, he has this majority in both chambers of the General Assembly, so it will be interesting to see if he follows through with that, if he even needs to follow through with that. I think, obviously, there will be somewhat more of a bipartisan approach when it comes to the Council of State, because there are a majority of Democrats, I believe, who are going to hold those seats moving forward. Didn't talk much policy today, was asked about immigration and privatizing liquor sales, his national role now as the governor, governor-elect, soon to be governor of North Carolina, and he really pushed off a lot of the specific transition questions to tomorrow, where he's going to have a meeting in Raleigh. But for the most part, it was really a lot of thank yous today and talking again about kind of the broad brushstrokes moving forward.
Well, our State House correspondent Jessica Jones is here as well. So Pat McCrory talking about bipartisanship, he really doesn't have to, right? I mean, the Democrats are not going to play a role in making laws in the state legislature.
Well, I think Democrats would hope that they would play a role. But now that both houses of the legislature and the governor is Republican, and this is historic, this hasn't happened since the horse and buggy days, this really is a new day for state politics in North Carolina. This is just something that hasn't happened in over a century.
So what is all this talk about bipartisanship? I mean, are there fractures? Is the conversation really among Republicans? And is that where all of the log rolling is going to go on? And if so, are there tensions within the party, or are they pretty much all sort of in lockstep with their agenda, do you think?
Well, I think it's a little early to tell, but certainly if you look at who the Republicans are in the legislature. I mean, there is a spectrum of ideologies, I guess I would say, with the legislation that was passed this last time around, it tended to be a little bit farther on the right. But there are plenty of moderate Republicans there as well. And some of them have complained that their voices have been drowned out. But at this point, you know, with both houses of the legislature being Republican, the Speaker of the House is still the same. The Senate President is still the same. We have a Republican governor. So I think what we're going to see is a continuation of many of the policies that we saw beginning in the session in 2011. And those are just going to continue.
Jeff, not only is McCrory the first Republican governor in 20 years, he won easily. And so what worked for them? How did that happen?
This also, it should be noted, it was closer than the polls had indicated in the final 5, 6, 7 weeks of this contest. I think one of the biggest factors here is that, you know, Pat McCrory lost the closest gubernatorial race in the country 4 years ago to Beverly Perdue, and he would tell you, he has said, that she was able to ride the Obama wave, so to speak. And he has spent much of the last 4 years campaigning. He's very well known. He has good name recognition. He raised 6 times the amount of money that his Democratic opponent, Walter Dalton, did. And, of course, he was the mayor of Charlotte for 14 years. Before that, he was a city council member in Charlotte. Add to that that Governor Perdue didn't make the announcement that she would step aside after one term until January, and you were dealing with a situation for the Democrats where there was a limited amount of time, a limited window where they could first pick the candidate. They had, of course, to hold that primary in May and choose Walter Dalton, the current and now outgoing lieutenant governor, to be their candidate. But he only had so much time to raise money and build that name recognition. And he said last night, he quoted Jerry Kramer, a former offensive lineman for the Green Bay Packers, who used to say he and the Packers had never lost a game. They simply ran out of time. And Walter Dalton said last night that his campaign just ran out of time.
Ran out of time. So the trend was right. And, you know, if there had just been a few more weeks or perhaps more, he may have won. But he didn't. And it was perceived as a race that would not be competitive. So Dave DeWitt and Jonathan Weiler, let me ask you whether or not that played a factor in Barack Obama's narrow loss in this state, the fact that the governor's race was not perceived as competitive.
Yeah, I was looking at some of these numbers this morning, and I'm constantly amazed about how few people vote straight ticket in this state. You know, if you vote straight ticket in this state, first of all, we're the only state in the country where that doesn't include the presidential race. So that makes a significant difference. You have to make a concerted effort to go vote for somebody. So that oftentimes gets people to split their tickets. But if you look at the Council of State races, all but 2 Democrats won, all the incumbents. So you get a situation there where people make informed decisions or somewhat informed decisions based on this council. That's impressive, I think, because who knows what the Department of Insurance does? And, Sherry Berry, for all I know, just puts stickers on elevators. It's hard to know really what those folks do, but there are people who are pretty informed about that. So certainly, I think in 2008, anybody who looked could say, okay, the Obama wave and if you go out with the Obama volunteers and they have a great ground game for the last 2 elections, you know, they are pushing other Democratic candidates too. And that makes a difference. So it could have been, you know, in 2008, Pat McCrory could have easily won if Barack Obama didn't have that momentum here. I don't know how much of an impact it had in this election, though. I think 2008, you could say 2012, it remains to be seen.
Jonathan?
Yeah, just a couple of points to add. One, you know, to Dave's point about coattails, it seems pretty clear that Kay Hagan in 2008 benefited tremendously from Obama's ground game. And I think there ought to be serious questions about how she'll do in 2014 in a very different electorate without the Obama ground game. I think the other thing I would say that's, you know, maybe for a little bit of context, you know, Obama won nationally in 2008 by 7 points and won in North Carolina by 1/3 of 1%. From that perspective, you know, you could argue he actually outperformed 2008 in North Carolina. He won nationally by 2.2. He lost here by 2.2. So, you know, which is only to say there probably, reasonably speaking, was a ceiling on his support that he might have come pretty close to maximizing.
And if there's a coattail effect, keep in mind that the ground game here did not include appearances by the president after the convention. He really didn't see this state in play very much. Well, we've talked a couple of times about the Council of State, so I want to introduce Isaac Davey Aronson to the conversation, who's been covering those Council of State elections. Isaac, welcome to the program.
Hi, Frank.
Tell us about those races, who they are, and who it is we do see. The thing about the elevator is it's great name recognition.
Oh,
so
yeah.
At least that position, you know who you're voting for.
That is absolutely true. And as Dave said, it's the one bright spot for Democrats in this election that of the 9 Council of State positions, the 6 of them remain in Democratic hands. All the incumbents won their races. There are 2 Republicans on the Council of State, one of whom is Sherry Berry, the labor commissioner, whose name is on all those elevators, as well as Steve Troxler, the agriculture commissioner. He also won. And then the Democrats who held on to their Council of State positions. And keep in mind that many of these Council of State positions have never been held by Republicans. And so some of the success here could be attributed to the name recognition and the length of time that some of these folks have been in the job, of course. But June Atkinson fended off a challenge from Republican Wake County School Board member John Tedesco for school superintendent. And Democratic State Auditor Beth Wood beat another Republican Wake County School Board member, Deborah Goldman, to hold on to her job. Of course, having a Democratic State Auditor who even Governor-elect McCrory has complimented in the past could be interesting over the next few years with such heavy Republican control of the government. And the other Democrats who held on to their jobs were Treasurer Janet Cowell and Secretary of State Elaine Marshall and Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin. I will say there is one election that is not yet been called, and that's the race for lieutenant governor, in which there was no incumbent because, of course, Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton was the Democratic nominee for governor. Republican Dan Forrest was running against Democrat Linda Coleman. Right now, Dan Forrest leads by about 11,000 votes, and the percentages are just about tied. He's claimed victory. Coleman has not yet conceded that race.
And this Council of State is essentially the cabinet, which ordinarily is appointed by the executive, not in this state, Jessica. So what impact is that going to have now when these cabinet positions essentially are going to be held largely by Democrats, Republican-controlled legislature? How does Pat McCrory – is that significant in terms of trying to run the state, being the governor of the state?
Well, I think when you were talking a little bit about bipartisanship earlier, I think that's where the bipartisanship is going to come in. And Pat McCrory has said that he's going to be pragmatic. He's talked about bipartisanship. So I would imagine that he would exercise that spirit when dealing with the members of the Council of State. And I do think it's also interesting that, you know, that he has spoken out in support of you know, at least one member of the Council of State. So I think that's probably what we're going to see moving forward on that front.
Isaac, let's talk about some other the officially nonpartisan races, the judicial races. In particular, Supreme Court Justice Paul Newby fended off a strong challenge from Sam Ervin IV. This was an interesting race. It's nominally nonpartisan, but Newby is a Republican and got a lot of support from the outside.
That's right. And Sam Ervin IV, who's a registered Democrat, of course, has that Ervin name that goes back a long way in North Carolina and had a lot of recognition for that. There was a lot of outside money going into this race, and people may have seen ads for this race more than perhaps they've seen judicial ads before. Some of us still have the catchy banjo song that was in the Paul Newby ad still stuck in our head. I think it'll be there for a while. But outside groups raised at least $2 million to back Newby's reelection. Some money also went into the Ervin side, although Sam Ervin was criticizing that money that was going into it. But Newby pulled it out by a couple of points.
Jessica, you've talked about that, the fact that outside interests have seen the state legislatures as kind of the new target, particularly if you don't think you can win at the national level.
That's right. Well, across the country, there are a number of Republican groups that have worked very, very hard to target state legislatures and funneled money into groups that will help bring Republican candidates into office. We saw some of that here in North Carolina in 2010, and I think we're seeing a continuation of it. And Republicans, both Republican donors, I guess I should say, both inside the state and outside the state, are organized. They're very organized. They got ahead of the game in terms of what Democrats are able to do, and they've really got a system now where they know exactly where they want to put their money. They're very organized about who they want to target. And they have really turned themselves into a political machine in a way.
A lot of money spent in this race. Jonathan Weiler, any indication about whether it might have distorted the results in some way?
I'm not sure about distorting. I mean, I obviously some people, especially in the wake of Citizens United, think we needed an overhaul of our entire campaign finance system. And I do think in some of these state races, like a judgeship where $2 million is spent, It's sure to have an enormous impact. One thing I'm interested in, and I know that folks will be studying this in the next couple of years, is there was so much money spent nationally. And it became a national joke that in the swing states, and we were one of them, pretty much all we heard every time we got in the car and turned on the radio or turned on the television was another political ad, such that, you know, we all wanted to throw our TVs out the window. But one wonders whether we reached and passed a saturation point where all of that advertising over and over again actually diluted the impact of, you know, negative ads. This is a funny way to say it, but they get a bad rap in the sense that people decry them, but political scientists will tell you they work. But I wonder whether we've now passed the point where we've seen and heard so much of them that they do start to have a diminishing return.
Television's out the window, one of the good effects of Citizens United. Dave?
Well, in the presidential race here in North Carolina, you know, we saw a lot of super PAC spending. American Crossroads, Crossroads GPS, all of the super PAC spending at the presidential level was all in support of Governor Romney. The super PAC that supported President Obama and even the Democratic National Committee didn't spend a dime here on television ads. So if that had an impact, and you know, President Obama did not win this state, and he did win it 4 years ago. So there'll be a lot of looking at that. People say, okay, what is the impact of that? And it'll be, you know, it was more than $20, $25 million that super PAC spent on television ads alone in this state. And, man, it makes you happy if you're somebody who's selling TV ad time at one of the TV stations.
Somebody made lots of money. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about, money obviously had an impact on this election, and redistricting, of course, had an impact, and particularly at the congressional level. At least nine of the members of our 13-member delegation will be Republicans, and that reflects two changes. Talk about those races, those key races in which we've seen a change in party membership.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that redistricting played a pretty major role in that, in so many of those seats. The Democrats did hold a 7-6 advantage going into this election. It's now going to be at least 9 on the Republican side. How much money played a factor? You know, Larry Kissel is out, and he lost pretty significantly. And there's the race with McIntyre and Rouser that's still somewhat up in the air. But, it sort of chased two Democratic congressmen right out of even running again. And that was a major impact. Once the incumbent leaves, name recognition goes and the seats are wide open. And those things like money have a bigger impact when people don't know who the candidates are that they're voting for.
If I could just add a quick point, you know, thinking about political stalemate, which is arguably one of the outcomes of last night on the national level, the Democrats retained the presidency in the Senate, the Republicans retained the House. The fact that Republicans won so decisively in 2010 gave them opportunities for redistricting in much of the country. And so it leaves us with the very likely prospect that we're going to have this kind of divided government for, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but 2020 is the next opportunity for redistricting. And we could be sort of frozen in this kind of dynamic for the next few cycles.
Well, and Jessica mentioned earlier sort of the historic nature of Republicans in the governor's office and also, at the legislature. Well, you know, and that's true at the congressional level, too. This is the first time Republicans have had a majority of congressional seats since Reconstruction, you know, and so almost at all levels of government. And it goes beyond that, too, because you look at something like the State Board of Education. You look at the Board of Governors that administers the UNC system. You're starting to see a lot of conservative Republicans getting seats on those boards. And you're going to see some changes. You're going to see some pretty dramatic changes made by those boards. And those policymaking boards have a lot of impact on what happens.
So policymaking boards aside for the moment, if you get back to what Jonathan, what you were saying about redistricting having an impact, you know, another 10 years out. And yet at the same time, we see the Republican Party in this moment of soul searching. So it's not clear what a Republican is going to look like in the next cycle if these changes and these conversations continue.
Yeah, the debate has already begun, as it does for any political party after they lose a major national election, about which direction they should go in. We talked about this a little bit before the show. My own sense is that Republicans, what will win the day among Republicans for the next couple of cycles at least, is to push even further in a conservative direction. I think that's where their base is. I think that's where their sort of base of power in the House of Representatives and among their base voters is clearly in that more conservative direction. And so, again, I do think at least for the next couple of cycles, we are likely to see more polarization, not less.
On the State of Things today, talking about what happened yesterday and what it means for tomorrow. And our conversation will continue right after this. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. You had to stay up past 1 a.m. last night, or this morning, I should say, to hear President Obama and Mitt Romney talk to their supporters. But the governor's race in North Carolina was called by 9 p.m. So what does all this tell us about politics here in the Tar Heel State? We've been talking about yesterday's results with Jonathan Weiler, a political scientist at UNC, and WUNC reporters Dave DeWitt, Jeff DeBerry, Isaac Davey Aronson, and Jessica Jones, all here today. So, Jeff, let me ask you, you said today's speech, news conference with Pat McCrory, didn't talk too much about policy. What do we glean from the campaign itself and from his record in terms of what we can expect about policy initiatives once he takes over the governor's mansion?
Customer service have been two of the most frequently used words by Pat McCrory during this campaign. He wants to create a business-like customer service philosophy in the state. He wants to lower corporate and personal income tax rates, and he wants to be competitive when it comes to corporate income tax rates with the neighboring states, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia. And he largely wants to get out of the way, is how he has put it. He and Walter Dalton also, I mean, they butted heads on a lot of different issues, but the indication is that McCrory wants to move forward with some new energy exploration steps. He wants to move forward with hydraulic fracturing, fracking, as it's commonly known, offshore oil drilling. And another, I think, big issue, obviously, in always, but certainly in the next few months and in the next year will be education. Pat McCrory has pledged to continue to put the same amount of money, if not more, into early childhood education because he thinks that's very important. But he's called for an overhaul to middle and high schools. He thinks that a revamp is necessary, and the indication, the writing on the wall, is that there may very well be a voucher system in place here in North Carolina.
That meshed pretty well with the priorities in the legislature, Jessica?
In terms of reducing personal and corporate income taxes, absolutely, and you know, with the changes in education as well. But one thing that lawmakers in the General Assembly are getting ready to do is they're getting ready to take a look at the tax code, and they really want to overhaul it and reduce the amount of taxes that people and companies pay. And that is a huge change for North Carolina. It may not be always the most exciting story to talk about news-wise, but it has enormous policy implications for people in this state. And so that's something that is definitely on the horizon.
Well, the two policies you think about when you think about taxes or cutting taxes are education. How are you going to pay for that? And health care, which is going to be a big issue these days with changes in our health care package nationally.
That's right. And now that, you know, they're well, I guess I'll just say lawmakers have been very concerned about what's going to happen with Obamacare and what is the state going to have to pay. And last night, even at the Republican Victory Party, there were some lawmakers who came up and talked to me about just how are we going to pay for this now that you know so much of the burden is being shifted to states? And I think that's a really big question moving forward. And education makes up, I think it's the largest part of the state budget. So, you know, how are you going to keep schools funded and going and yet pay for all these responsibilities and lower taxes? That's going to be something that lawmakers are really going to have to hash out moving forward.
Is this where the rubber hits the road? People have an interest in education. They have an interest in health care. They don't want to pay taxes. If you're the party out of power, it's real easy to take shots at people raising your taxes. Now you have to govern. Will that make a difference, do you think, going forward, Jonathan?
It's a good question. I think, you know, I just want to make a quick comment related to your question, but also on a point that Jessica made about how the state of North Carolina is going to pay for Medicaid expansion, which is one of the most significant parts of Obamacare. And the Supreme Court left the door open in its June decision that states could opt out of Medicaid expansion if they wanted to. The law says that for the first 3 years, the federal government will pay for 100% of Medicaid expansion, then 95%, then 90%. So actually, the states get a good economic deal out of Medicaid expansion. Not only do they put more people on health care, but they actually get more money to pay for it. So my concern, I suppose, is when lawmakers talk about their concerns about paying for it, I think some of them, they're sincere and they're confused about the law. But it sort of raises questions about how much these kinds of priorities are being pitted against one another when the given for the Republican Party is we have to cut taxes no matter what.
Isaac Davey Aronson, let me ask you a question about this question of polarization and the direction of the Republican Party, you know, the role of the Tea Party and pushing the Republicans farther to the right. What impact do you see that, or did you see that having on the election? Certainly, it's interesting in the Council of State elections that Democrats held so many of their seats.
Yeah, it is interesting, and certainly we'll see this play out, as I know that Dave and Jonathan can speak to, and Jessica as well, in the legislature and with Governor McCrory. You know, I think that, say, Governor McCrory, many people might say, is a very different kind of Republican than many of the Republicans in the legislature. And in the Council of State races, incumbent Democrats often found themselves facing off against Republican challengers who were pretty on the right side of the spectrum, if you will. I mean, particularly in the treasurer's race, Janet Cowell was being challenged by a CPA from Elkin named Steve Royal, who felt that North Carolina should band together with neighboring states to have its own alternate currency, because he felt that the status quo of the national and state economy was about to collapse. And that's a pretty fringe view, even in the Republican Party. I will say that in one of the things that's most interesting to me is that in this race, this one race that's undecided, and if a recount goes forward, could be undecided for weeks, in the lieutenant governor's race between Democrat Linda Coleman and Republican Dan Forrest, you know, the lieutenant governor sits on a lot of policymaking boards, but doesn't actually really have any policy execution duties, if you will. And so that race really became largely about ideology, and you could really see one of the major splits in North Carolina politics happening in this race, or some of the major themes, that being that Dan Forrest, the Republican, Tea Party backed, spoke in very conservative language about what he wanted to do. Linda Coleman, a longtime legislator and then government bureaucrat who had a lot of backing from the State Employees Association. And by the end of the race, they were going at each other with political ads, accusing each other of being on the wrong side of all kinds of social issues like abortion that have nothing to do, of course, or very little to do with the lieutenant governor's position. And so that sort of Tea Party versus longtime government bureaucrat fight playing out in this one Council of State race where there was no incumbent and no particular duties to argue over.
Dave, do it.
Frank, I'll be really fascinated to just see, sort of picking up on Isaac Davey's point about what will happen in that dynamic between Governor McCrory and the Republican leadership in the legislature. Which issues will Governor McCrory sort of take the lead on, and which ones will he sort of let the legislature have their way? You know, as the mayor of Charlotte, he never really had to get too involved in education issues, for example. The last governors we've had all like to tout themselves as the education governor, going back, you know, a century or so. So it'll be interesting to see how much of a lead he'll take in that. And there are some things that the legislature really wants to do, not just expand charter schools, which they're well on the way to doing, but private school vouchers, for example, and other things. And these will have long-term political effects, because if education does get funded at a lower level, and it's almost a certainty if they end up lowering tax rates, then all of a sudden the voters who put these folks into office are going to see their schools start to deteriorate a little bit, and they're going to see their teachers maybe leave and go somewhere else. And there's going to be a lot of changes that may or may not have a political effect down the line. But it'll also, in my mind, go back to what will Governor McCrory take the lead on and sort of want to be his issues, and which ones will he just sort of go along with the legislature and let them have their way? Because, you know, voter ID, there's some things that I think we can all see on the horizon. There are other things that it'll be interesting to see how much of it, because he's been a moderate. You know, when he was a Charlotte mayor, he was a moderate. He didn't really get pressed on social issues as running in his gubernatorial race. It'll be interesting to see him define himself in that leadership role and see what how he works with the legislature.
Well, and that is the question. Jessica, he has run as a moderate. Can he govern as a centrist given the position on the spectrum that the legislature now occupies?
Well, it's not like there aren't centrists in the legislature, certainly, but there are just so many interests, especially right now, so many dogs in this fight in the legislature. And there are a lot of we've seen a lot of legislation and a lot of bills that have been pushed forward that are motivated by a social agenda. And so I think it's a really good question. I feel like I can't answer it because we don't know exactly how our next governor is going to deal with that. But I think it is going to be complicated. And I wonder if there's going to be kind of a public persona, but then a different private persona, probably a lot of closed door talks about, you know, do we really want to push this forward? Is this really good for us, you know, when it comes to being reelected? Whose interests are we really going to represent? I'm sure there will be lots of conversations. I just don't know how open and public those conversations are going to be.
I think the one prediction we can make is that the one issue that Governor McCrory is most known for is light rail in Charlotte. I doubt he'll take a lead on transportation issues because he wants to get away a little bit from that. He ran away from that a little bit, and when he ran for governor, this sort of, you know, that's a transportation, public transportation tends to be a more of a left-center issue. He won't take a lead in that, I guarantee you, as a governor.
Yeah, just one point. Jessica had talked earlier about how well organized Republicans were both in North Carolina and nationally. And I think in some ways that bears on, it doesn't tell us definitively, but it bears on what kind of governor McCrory will be. Because I think there is a sense in which our politics have all become nationalized. You know, in the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which has gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of years, is a good example. They're writing model legislation that legislatures are adopting almost word for word in a number of states. Voter ID is a good example of an issue that they've been pushing. And they got a lot of flack when Trayvon Martin was shot and killed because those stand your ground laws were laws that they had pushed. So I think that McCrory, it will be an interesting test of his independence, given not only the rightward shift of the Republican Party in North Carolina, but this kind of increasingly nationalized political scene that we're all operating in.
And if customer service are the two main words, I suppose the second pair would be voter ID. That's been an issue that Pat McCrory has run on and is important to him. Jessica?
That's right. And Republican leaders in the legislature have been really interested in that. I think we're going to see that bill surface again. And when McCrory was campaigning as governor, he actually asked people when they went to the polls to pull out their photo ID and show it and say, here's my ID. So it's become a very politicized issue, but it, you know, much of that is brought forward by groups like ALEC and other similar groups. And we really do see their influence. Now, that's not to say that Republican leaders, you know, are not, it's not that they're not enthusiastic about the idea, but I think there's a reason why we're hearing it so often and other issues like it as well. But that certainly is one that I think we're going to be talking about again in the next legislative session.
Jeff Tiberi, any sense from Pat McCrory and about whether certainly it's an issue, voter ID is important to him? Is it important to North Carolina voters, and is it something that he feels he can push safely in this state?
Now, I got the feeling that it is something that it was fairly high on his agenda to deal with and to look at once he moves into this next role. I mean, as Jessica just alluded to, I mean, this is something that has some support, has a decent amount of support in the General Assembly, and I think that we're going to be hearing more about it in the months to come.
Isaac, what is your sense in terms of the issues that are going to be top on the agenda? Any sense that you got in covering this campaign? What's going to top the agenda? Will it be the governor pushing the agenda? Will he take the lead from the leadership in the House and the Senate? How do you think it's going to go?
Well, as everyone's been saying, you know, it's tough to say at this point, although obviously as we've been hearing from Jeff, what Pat McCrory really seems to be saying right now and today in his press conference is really striking this tone of, as Jeff said, customer service. There's nothing ideological, if you will, about customer service. And but I think that there are probably quite a few leaders in the legislature who are itching to get a few things done that they didn't get done when Bev Perdue was governor. And frankly, you know, I think that with the increase in their majorities in the House and the Senate, that they now have veto-proof majorities in both chambers, if there are things that Pat McCrory doesn't want to go along with them on, that they may not need him.
Well, good. I'm glad, because the first thing I'm going to do is have him fix this problem I've got on my phone bill. I've got a charge on there. I could not possibly have made that, and I've been on hold for a week and a half. So Pat McCrory is going to fix that, and I'm happy to know that. Dave, let me ask you this about again, going forward, if we look at Jonathan Wyler talking about the increasingly sort of nationalized politics that make their way to the legislatures. Regional splits used to be one of the important divides in any state, the rural-urban split. In this state, it's the sort of recreational versus the industrial parts of the state. Are those in play here anymore? Are they as important as they used to be?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it depends on the race. For example, the governor's race, Pat McCrory comes from Charlotte, and that's a first. When the Democrats had the lock on the governor's race, they were all coming from down east. And now we've got a Republican coming from Charlotte. That's a new wrinkle. And Frank, looking forward, I think you talk about regional and local politics. I mean, the thing I'm looking forward to most isn't necessarily in the legislature or anything like that. I just want to go to the first Wake school board meeting, because the folks who ran for the Council of State did not win. And now they're going back, and I'm not going to go into all the stuff that has happened in the last month or so. But that first Wake school board meeting, when all those candidates who lost came back and are in a sour mood and already don't like each other, all the Republicans I'm talking about, that's going to be a corker.
Well, we will stay tuned and have you all back. Meanwhile, it's been a pleasure. Dave DeWitt, Jeff Tabiri, Isaac Davey Aronson, Jessica Jones, and Jonathan Wyler, who is Director of Undergraduate Studies and Adjunct Assistant Professor of Global Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, which you can find online at stateofthings.org. And you can join us this Friday at the Triad Stage downtown Greensboro. We're going to be there live. Right up the road in Greensboro, Triad Stage, noon on Friday. Send us an email, rsvp@wunc.org, and join us to be part of our audience on stage. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.